We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. The Adult Improver series is back. I just wrapped recording a great interview with an accomplished improver, Denis Markov, who's gained hundreds of points while he has two young kids at home and maintaining a full-time job. But as you will hear Denis discuss, he makes chess a priority. He spends at least an hour a day on it, and he competes frequently, and it's paid great dividends for him. So Denis doesn't feel like he's doing anything revolutionary, but I think his story really shows the value of daily practice. And we will get you to that interview in a minute. But first, I wanted to give a shout out to Perpetual Chess Patreon supporters. You guys make a huge difference in keeping the podcast going. And of course, those who support Perpetual Chess via Patreon are able to submit questions for guests. They're also able to join the Perpetual Chess Discord. For those who join at the $5 per month tier, you can get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess. And of course, any Perpetual Chess Patreon member can attend the occasional Zoom hangout or Grandmaster lecture, as the case may be. We will be organizing another one soon. I wanted to particularly give a shout out to recent Perpetual Chess Patreon pledges, including James Wilson, John Messier, Go-Go Ranger. I'm suspicious that Go-Go Ranger's real name is Go-Go Ranger. John Callahan, Chris Moore, Fletcher Ray, and Jacob Ludwig. Thanks for supporting the pod. If anyone else is interested in joining the Perpetual Chess Patreon community, as always, the link will be in the show description. Also wanted to give a quick shout out to our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable. Chessable is dropping some bangers. So I already mentioned that Silman's Endgame course is out now. Obviously, that's a must-have, and it's exciting to have I am Alex Bonzea presenting the content. He is a great presenter, and it's like, as I've mentioned in my book and other places, one-stop shopping for learning your basic end games all the way up to the master level. So it's great that that is finally on Chessable, but they've got some great new stuff too. Friend of the pod, legendary trainer and author Johan Helsten is out with a new course, Mastering Chess Defense. Obviously, that's a must-have. Chess trainers love his material because he always has so many well-explained positions, and chess improvers can always learn so much from this fantastic teacher. And another friend of the pod, Grandmaster Erwin Lamy, when I interviewed him more than a year ago, he mentioned he was working on a Slav course, and it is now out. There is a Lifetime Repertoires Slav course by Grandmaster Erwin Lemie, one of the top theoreticians in the world. Of course, he's worked as a second for Topalov and Anish Giri. And as is often the case, you can check out a free preview from Chessable. So check out that, as well as a lot of my all-time favorites. And yeah, that's about it in terms of housekeeping. I'm excited to get you to this interview with Denis Markov. So let's get you straight to it. I hope you enjoy it. And we are here with Denis Markov. Denis is a 39-year-old who works full-time as a director of operations in a large company. He's got two kids, 2 and 4 years old. Denis recently made a popular Reddit post detailing how he went from 1740 to 2040 USCF in just 2 years. It's not going to surprise you that part of the answer to that is he worked very hard. Denis actually lives not very far from where I live in New Jersey, so I have met him a couple times at local tournaments. Was not aware of this landmark success that he had until I saw the post, but now I'm super excited because I think his approach is very logical, and I think we all can learn a lot from how he has approached chess and why he's been able to make these excellent chess gains. So, Denis, congratulations and welcome to the pod. Good to chat.
Thank you, Ben. It's great to be here. I really appreciate your invitation. And I've been a huge fan of the podcast. So it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and you're quite the success story as well. I mean, it's, you know, listeners who listen every week or listen to all the Adult Improver interviews will probably have heard me struggle recently with like trying to find the right balance between highlighting people like yourself who are kind of like the outliers. I mean, let's face it, not everyone is able to gain 300 points in a couple years, especially when they're starting from the relatively high level of the 1700s. So I do think it's great to share people like yours's stories, but I also want people to know that won't happen for everyone. But nonetheless, there's certainly things to learn from your approach, and I'm eager to dig into that as you have done in your Reddit post. And I know we've exchanged some emails and stuff, so I have an inkling of why you've been so successful. But before we get into what drove your success, I'm curious, what drives your work ethic? I mean, as you've written, you play 80 to 90 rated games a year. You've got a busy life, yet when your kids go to bed, you're doing puzzles for 60 to 90 minutes. So to quote my friend Avtek Gregorian, what is your why? Why are you working so hard, Denis?
Look, I mean, I generally love the game, right? When it comes to chess, I like the logic of the game. I like the harmony of the game. I like you know, geometry of the board. I like pieces interactions. I like the development of different plans. Something that sort of attracts me from my professional perspective as well is the way of thinking about a chess game, right? So when you're playing this, you constantly have to go from this larger strategic level when you think about the whole board, about plans, about, you know, major strategic themes, like which side of the board should you be playing on, for example. And then you always have some very tactical motifs. When you go to specific moves, you need to calculate certain move orders, and you need to somehow find smaller tactical things in this large strategic plan, right? So that's what excites me about the game, right? When it comes to working hard, I think my general approach when it comes to anything in life is trying to improve at whatever I do. You know, if I'm interested in something, if I'm passionate about something, I just try to work harder on that because it's interesting to discover new things. It's interesting to find new ideas. You know, it's interesting to see what's next, what's around the corner.
And do you have days, I mean, so again, giving up your nights often after the kids go to bed, like, are there days where you don't want to do it, or are you just always excited to study chess?
No, there are definitely days when I'm not really feeling like studying chess a lot, and that could be related to some personal issues, personal events in my life, right? Let's say recently I had to travel 10 time zones away from where I live, so that was pretty painful in terms of adjusting to you know, time changes and all these things. So I didn't spend too much time working on chess. But on the other hand, I'm generally very curious about, you know, studying something new, you know, going through some interesting topics, you know, maybe solving some tactics. So in general, I like this, right? And then I think there is also a difference between, again, you know, tactical and strategic perspective, right? Because whatever you do in your life, I think you might hate it at some points, right? Even if you like your job, you will still have some routine in it, right? If you study chess, all right, there will be something you're not super excited about, you know, like rook end games are not necessarily my favorite topic, right? But then I know that I want to improve. This is why I would study those as well. And you know, I know that it takes its part in the big scheme of things, right?
Yeah, well, speaking of your 10 hours of travel, I was going to get a Turkey trip report from you before we started recording, but I forgot. So when we stop recording or at the end, we might need to discuss your travels a little bit. But for now, we'll keep it strictly chess focused. So Dennis, on those days where your motivation is not as high, do you force yourself to do it, or do you give yourself the occasional day off from the chess routine?
I try to do a little bit, right? But a little bit sometimes means, I don't know, 10 minutes of solving tactics. You know, I would wake up and instead of scrolling my social networks, I would be like, all right, let me solve a couple things here and there, right? Or, you know, during the lunch break or maybe before going to bed, I would still try to at least look at some positions, but it's not like hard work. Sometimes it's like, hey, you know, I just need my chess tempo streak to keep going. You know, right. I will solve a puzzle or two just, you know, to have something today.
Okay. Yeah, I've definitely struggled with the streaks. As I wrote in my book, I had a 400-day streak on Chessable that I lost. And then I couldn't get one going because once it was low, I just like couldn't keep my motivation. Finally got one going again. And it was over 100 days. And then I had a thing where I swear I did review some openings that day, but I logged in the next day and it said my streak was gone. And I didn't try to pull any strings at Chessable to get it reinstated. So ever since then, my motivation's been gone again. So those streaks can be super powerful. And so you mentioned 90 minutes again at night, in addition to like, it should, you know, we should definitely highlight the frenetic tournament schedule, the busy tournament schedule you're playing as well. I know that you're married. You mentioned, I think it was in your Reddit post, that your wife is an artist, so she has a more flexible schedule than you do. But is she okay with you spending all this time on chess? Is she generally supportive?
She's super supportive, and she's probably the best wife I could, well, not probably, she's definitely the best wife I could ever wished for. And, you know, I think we both try to support each other in our passions, right? So she's all into art, and, you know, every once in a while she would have some either art classes or live drawing sessions, or, you know, she would have to travel somewhere to do something over there, and you know, I will stay with kids and she would do what she needs to do. But then when it comes to chess, she would give me some personal time as well. And I think it's just a good balance to keep, right? On one hand, we have a lot of things in our lives that go together, but on the other hand, we also have our own hobbies and passions and, you know, things we like doing. And when it comes to kids specifically, right, we also discussed that quite extensively, right? And we want our kids to see us being passionate about something, being interested in something, right? Not just being, you know, not just giving up everything, all right, you know, now our life stops because our kids' life starts, right? No, that's not the case. You know, we want to share our passions. You know, kids are excited about art. You know, they like drawing, they like doing something when it comes to, you know, painting or doing things like that. And when it comes to chess, they are just 2 and 4 years old, but, you know, they start showing some interest at least, maybe, you know, not like super in-depth, not learning how to play, but at least, you know, they know what the board looks like, they know pieces, they put these pieces on the squares, they try to, you know, play some imaginary game with each other. That's kind of cool to see as well. You know, I don't necessarily want them to share this passion, or at least, you know, I want them to do whatever they want with it, but it's cool to see that they look at things around them and they try to get a little bit of everything.
Yeah, we actually had a question from a Patreon supporter of the pod, Noah Zucker, wondering with you being so passionate about chess, if you had plans for your kids in chess, but it sounds like you're open-minded about it.
Yeah, look, my only plan for my kids is to be happy, right? There are plenty of different things you can do in this world. You can try different professions. You can even change things that you do, right? In my life, I started as a journalist, then I went into finance industry, and then last 10 years, I've been doing operations in industrial environment, right? In warehouses, in manufacturing settings and things like that. So you can try a lot of things along the way, right? And you can be successful in different things. So when it comes to kids, I want them to choose. They show some interest right now. Like, for example, my 2-year-old son, he has this book called Chess for Kids, and essentially just explains what pieces are called, and it shows how they move. And you have like a cardboard book, you know, and there are like small grooves for your fingers so that you can sort of trace how bishop moves, how rook moves, how pawn moves. And then, you know, he starts reading that, he recognizes all the pieces, and it's kind of funny to hear him, like, some of his first words, you know, he says mommy and daddy and all these things. But then, you know, slightly later, he goes through this book with us and he starts saying that, you know, papa is a rook, mama is a bishop, and I am a rook as well. And, you know, that kind of things, you know, he doesn't necessarily understand all the meaning of it, but it's cool to see him, you know, getting a little bit of chess related things in his life.
And it sounds like, again, even though you're open-minded, you are passionate enough about chess where, like, you made sure he got his hands on that book at least, and then he can decide how far to go from there.
I think that's for sure. I feel like, you know, life is about passions, right? So I'm passionate about something, but then, you know, there are some other people around me who are passionate about something else. I feel like if someone is truly passionate about something, it's almost inevitable that this passion will at least try to spread around. So hopefully he gets a little bit of it.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned your passion for chess, Dennis, but, you know, you've sent me some information about your background, and it's kind of, from my perspective, this is not unusual, but it's been in fits and starts. I mean, you mentioned you growing up in the former Soviet Union, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were born in Ukraine and then lived in Russia, is that right?
Yep, that's correct. I was born in Kyiv in Ukraine, and when I was about 7 years old, my parents moved to Moscow, to Russia, and this is where I spent about 20 years of my life before moving to the United States to study, and eventually I stayed here to work.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, but you mentioned you pursued chess for a bit at the famed Palaces of Pioneers, which of course were these government sponsored, not just chess, you know, not just chess quote palaces, but ballet and other extracurriculars, where kids could devote a lot of time to certain activities that whatever they found enriching and whatever they might have shown some predisposition for. But you mentioned that at that time you didn't feel like you were anything special and it didn't really take. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, and also eventually, like, what you think has changed in recent years.
Well, I don't think much has changed in that sense. I don't think I'm anything special. I just went to study some chess back then. I didn't know much about all the rich culture of chess, about all the history, right? About all the different things one can learn about chess. I essentially knew how pieces moved, and then at some point, my parents thought that it would be a pretty good idea for someone of, you know, of my age to develop their logic, develop their, you know, maybe some, I don't know, social skills, if you can develop social skills from chess, but at least, you know, you can sit quietly and think about something and try to figure something over the board. So that was more of a childhood development thing as opposed to a sport, I guess, when it comes to how my family was thinking about this. And back then I had, I think, a couple classes per week where you would go there, you would have some sort of coaching session where a coach would walk you through some game or maybe, you know, explain some basic concepts. And then you would play one tournament game per week, I believe. And this is more like a long tournament where you had, let's say, 10 participants, each person playing with each participant, right? And eventually you score a certain amount of points. And then we had our, you know, fourth category norms, third category norms. So there was some sort of system for titles, but not necessarily a rating, right? We were not thinking about any rating points back then. Just sort of moving from one category to another, which sort of showed your performance. And there were some larger tournaments of, you know, a particular district of Moscow, for example, where pupils from some of these chess schools would get together and, you know, essentially play a tournament. I also had a couple of these experiences.
And any future, I mean, my impression from, you know, from all the interviews I've done and just from studying chess culture, it feels like you can shake a tree and like a grandmaster will fall out in the former Soviet Union. Were there any future GMs that you remember, or were you too young?
I was probably too young to remember back then. I think the system overall, right, if you think about the sports development system in the Soviet Union, it was almost like, you know, someone actually described this as throwing a million eggs against the wall. And, you know, most of them will crack, but one of them will not. And this is going to be your future world champion, right? So I think one of the goals of these establishments was to get as many people as possible through them. And then whenever some talent was identified, you could have some more in-depth classes and activities and study sessions with someone who is a good coach and who can develop you in a better player.
Okay. Yeah. And Timothy Ha, another Patreon supporter of the pod, thank you for helping to support Perpetual Chess. Timothy, he submitted a question, and it turns out when I announced that you were a guest, he's on the same team as you in Elite Chess League. The team is called the Adult Decliners, which, by the way, they might need to kick you off because you are not declining. But Dennis asks, he says, do you think that being a Russian speaker matters for chess? Do you find Russian chess culture helpful in your improvement, or is it all the same in the age of the internet and translated books?
It's a good question. First, I think maybe saying Russian chess culture, we may be slightly oversimplify what it actually is, right? Because when we think about the Soviet history of chess, it's obviously not only about Russia. You know, you can think about the great Ukrainian school of chess, you know, for example, the school of chess in the city of Lviv, where Vasily Ivanchuk is coming from, where Muzychuk sisters are coming from, and then, you know, a very well-known chess school in Kramatorsk with Ruslan Ponomaryov, and I think Sergei Karyakin participated in some activities out there back in his, you know, Ukrainian days. And then you can also think about countries like Georgia and Armenia, and, you know, Kazakhstan is taking some space, you know, right now. And then, you know, obviously all the chess prodigies from Uzbekistan, that's quite a thing right now as well. So even going back to Soviet times, there were some particular centers of chess, some, you know, cities well known for, you know, local chess culture, and they were similar in a way, but they were also different in a way, right? But then when it comes to how language relates to this, I feel like most of the content right now is available in English or maybe in some other languages as well. Maybe when it comes pretty handy is when I get my hands on some really old Soviet book, which has never been translated. Like, for example, you know, I'm going through analytical notes of Botvinnik right now, and this is a three volume, you know, set of books going back from like 60s or 70s, I believe. And it's good, it's valuable. There are a lot of good Botvinnik games annotated by himself. I think it was translated in English, but it was published by some, you know, strange publishing house, which didn't really promote it too well. So I'm not sure if you can actually find those books. But now the question is, do you actually need those analytical notes? Is this absolutely critical for anyone to succeed? And most likely it's not a deal breaker, right? So I think it's convenient, right? It's convenient to get into some Russian language sources. But we are also very far from Bobby Fischer's times, where he had to study Russian just to get hold of some, you know, Russian magazines and newspapers and get some chess-related information out of them. Luckily, we have enough content in either language right now.
Yeah, if anything, maybe it kind of, you know, keeps you motivated because there's that rich legacy culturally from your sort of, I guess, primarily Ukrainian, but also Russian heritage. But yeah, these days there's just so many ways to learn.
When we get back, we will hear what got Dennis back into chess in his college years, and then he'll get into his study routine. We'll be right back.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Olly.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
And we are back. And before we get sort of deep on what you've done to make this great chess improvement, I do kind of want to just finish the story of when you took time away from chess after attending the Palace of Pioneers, and then when you got back into it. So could you reveal that timeline for us?
You know, it was somewhat random. I think when I was in my early college years, at some point I had a very much unexplainable desire to play some chess. I don't know why, right? I just thought that, hey, you know, there are so many things on the internet right now. Maybe I need to find a way of playing chess online. And the best thing I could find was some website on yahoo.com. And it obviously super casual, right? I don't think they ever had any like anti-cheating systems or anything, you know, very, you know, casual players, you know, office workers playing against each other. I don't think it ever had any, you know, like professional chess community. But I went out there, I played some games, I enjoyed them, and I thought that, hey, maybe I can learn a little bit more about the game. Maybe, in fact, you know, e4, e5, queen f3 is not the best opening. Maybe there are better ways of developing pieces. And somehow I got hold of my system. I know it's a little bit of a controversial book. Some people will be super passionate about it. Some people will say that this is like the worst book ever written on chess. I think it helped me. It helped me in a way that I read it and I thought, oh, wait a second. There are better ways of thinking about the game, right? So I went into it. I tried to study a little bit. And then, you know, I did more research on the internet. I found Play Chess. I started playing online. And I played for a while, but then I never felt like I had a proper community where I could be a member of. And this what led me to different things in my life. You know, I graduated from college, I pursued a career, and I never really thought about chess until fairly recently.
Okay, and what got you back into it recently?
Maybe just, you know, the development of online resources. So next time I tried, you know, to play a game of chess online, I found something better than, you know, that casual website. I found some, you know, websites where you can read news about chess. I found some forums, found some discussions, and somehow that feeling of community got me in. I realized that, you know what, it's actually pretty, you know, common to have some interest in chess. And there are a lot of people who used to play as kids and then they forgot about it. And then at some point they made a comeback and they realized that, hey, you know what, you can enjoy it anytime in your life at any age. And I sort of, you know, just got pulled in and you know, never could get out of it.
Yeah. But again, you've shown decent progress and I have to say I approve of the sort of framework you've adopted, because there's certainly some echoes of some of the stuff I've written about, and that you've got an emphasis on doing puzzles, you've got an emphasis on community, you're playing a ton at your local club and finding ways to play even beyond that, and an emphasis on game review. So those are kind of the major points that I highlight, and obviously you've been doing this for years, and you know, as you mentioned to me when before we were recording, one doesn't need to reinvent the wheel, but still it can be hard to settle on the sort of right components, especially if you're sort of, obviously you had some chess culture, you knew about the chess world, but still there's such a mass of information. So Dennis, I'm curious, like, how you settled on those few things, and if there were sort of growing pains along the way where you were doing sort of what you now consider to be less productive things.
Growing pains is actually maybe the main topic of the whole story, right? In a sense that not necessarily all the activities that you like, chess or anything else, right? Not necessarily all of them are made of, you know, 100% pleasure, you know? Part of that is that you want to improve, and you know that some parts of that improvement journey, they're going to be very nice and pleasant and exciting, and you will be doing something that you really like doing, but maybe parts of that are going to be things that you just have to do, right? So when you have this perspective and you think that, hey, I want to get better at chess because getting better at chess will help me to learn the game better, understand more, have better ideas, better plans, see better logic, see games more in depth. When you think about this, you realize that, hey, it's worth improving, even if sometimes it's not that exciting, you know, not that amazing from the perspective of, you know, enjoying every second of it, right? So I think that's the biggest thing about my approach is just I know that it's going to be a mix of, you know, interesting things and routine. It's going to be a mix of something that, you know, makes me truly excited about the game and something that is maybe not that exciting. But I know that overall it makes the whole thing well, right? It makes the whole thing more full, more maybe... more
gratifying,
right. It sort of adds to your experience, and then when you have good and bad things about the journey, then it all comes together as a better experience as a whole.
Okay, and so what are the things that? So you mentioned you're doing some things that you're not as excited to do, and some that you are. What are the things that you're excited to do?
I generally like solving tactics. I realize that it's just important to stay in shape, not necessarily. You need, I would say in general, you know, when people think about tactics, they think about improving calculations. And at some point, I realized that, all right, maybe, you know, maybe at a higher level, I truly need much better calculation skills. But also when you're around maybe 1500, 1600, you sort of tend to overvalue the importance of calculation. In fact, you need to calculate next 2-3 moves, do this precisely, but you don't necessarily have to calculate long lines, right? But at least, you know, in terms of staying in shape, in terms of seeing some, you know, tactical motifs, that's important, right? I feel like time spent on tactics is always useful. If you cannot do anything else, just do some tactics. And then I think when it comes to strategic play, end game strategy, middle game strategy, that's pretty exciting as well, because this is essentially about your decision making in a game of chess. And it also evolves over time, and it also improves over time. And spending more time consciously thinking about moves over the board makes you better at it. So I think these are most exciting things for me.
Okay, and the less exciting parts?
You know, a while ago I would say opening study. But I think now I realize there are better ways of studying openings, right? Not just memorizing moves, not just, you know, following particular lines, not just trying to follow some, you know, ambiguous line with, you know, plus or minus or whatever evaluation at the end, but more of trying to think about how your opening moves relate to your middle game strategy and what's the actual purpose of each move. And then when you see this as a system, right? When you see those things connected, I feel like you can study openings in a way more meaningful, in a way more mindful way, right? When you just don't think about moves, you think about ideas behind these moves. And that makes it pretty exciting as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your Reddit post that you've been working with a grandmaster coach and that he helped you see the light in that regard.
Oh, exactly. Right. My grandmaster coach is David Arutinian. He is coming from the Republic of Georgia, and he's a FIDE senior trainer. He used to work with some well-known players, some well-known grandmasters. Among those names, I would probably mention, well, Katie Tsatsalashvili, who is a very prominent chess commentator nowadays, but she's also a pretty strong player, and she's a woman grandmaster. Then Jansai Abdumalik, the famous Kazakhstan player, and he used to be a coach of the Georgian Olympic team. So, and as a player, he was slightly below 2600 at his peak, and then he moved on to full-time coaching, right? So when we started studying, my initial thought was that, hey, I'm going to get a coach, and I will maybe work on my opening repertoire, and maybe we'll go through some game analysis, and, you know, I had very sort of broad idea of what I wanted from this, right? But then when we started looking at certain games, he started asking some very basic questions that I never had any answers for. Like, for example, I show him a game of mine and I show a certain opening and he's asking, so what are your plans for this game? And I'm like, what do you mean? What are my plans, right? I'll just take it move by move. And he says, all right, are you playing on the king side or on the queen side? Let's start with basics. And I don't know, right? And he says, all right, maybe, you know, there are different ways. You know, there are different ways of playing a game, but there is also a great wealth of, you know, great depth of chess knowledge that has been built over years. And there are certain typical plans, certain typical ideas, certain typical pawn structures that can make this thought process a little bit more meaningful for you. And then the same way as you can work on some tactical patterns, you know, you have certain motifs that you keep rehearsing and then, you know, they get more automated. Same way you can do this with strategic ideas, with pawn structures, with typical plans, and then you just don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. You just know what is typically done in those positions. And you can also use mistakes made by your opponents when you see that they do something strategically wrong from the very beginning. The engine is not going to tell you this, right? You will look at the engine is going to say that, let's say, you know, it's slightly better for you, it's plus 0.5 or whatever, but then maybe it's plus 0.5, but the game is already strategically lost for your opponent because they just went the route where they will not have any active play for the rest of the game. So why don't you think more about strategy? That was his advice and that was his conclusion. And we started exploring more strategic components of the game. And I think that made me realize that, you know, I've been thinking about the whole game of chess in a slightly wrong way.
So you started to learn to think more big picture about your openings and focusing less on lines. And what advice would you have for listeners about the nuts and bolts of doing that?
I would say playing slow games, that's definitely super helpful. Games where you can actually think about every move. And then later when you try to do some analysis, you remember why certain moves were made or were not made, right? That's one thing. The second one is trying to look more into annotated games. And in that sense, let's say the chess-based database might be helpful, or just, you know, searching something online, or maybe trying to find some educational videos. Not entertaining videos, right? But videos where a strong player would do in-depth analysis and they would explain some ideas, some thoughts behind certain moves. And I think the biggest thing is not just seeing computer eval, or the biggest thing is not just seeing that, hey, you know, all right, I had a choice of certain moves here and I made this move and it went from, let's say, plus one to minus two and this is how I lost, right? The question is, what exactly was wrong with this move and what was wrong with your plan and where did it go the wrong direction so that that mistake happened? Because, by the way, you know, if your computer eval goes from, let's say, one to 0.2, not necessarily this is just a straightaway simple blunder, right? Maybe you chose the wrong plan in the first place, and this is what led you to the point where you had to make a very difficult choice in very difficult circumstances in a position that's not necessarily, you know, positive for you, right? Not necessarily this position is easy to play, right? So maybe you just went with the wrong plan in the first place, and this is what you led you to that specific mistake. But then when you see the whole thing, when you see things more strategically, you can make better calls, better decisions, and you can understand your games better. I would say well annotated games is definitely the best source of knowledge for that.
Okay, and as someone, Dennis, who plays as often as you do, by the way, I mean, with you playing so many OTB games a year, I can't believe you're doing the Lee Chess League with Timothy Ha as well.
Oh, I stopped, okay. Right. Yeah, I've been doing it for quite a while, and then I realized I would focus on OTB chess better. But we still have our group on Slack where we have all our team members. Maybe now there are 20 of us coming from different seasons, but somehow they stick around Timothy, and he's our eternal captain, you know, leading us to the bright future. Even though some of us do not play that actively, we still stay in touch. We talk to each other. We share some, you know, experiences from tournaments, from OTB games. We follow each other games on Lee Chess. So we're still together, though not necessarily all of us are participating.
Okay, that's great. It was one of those things where I'm like trying to add up the hours in your week. And I'm like, hold on, he's doing the Lee Chess League as well. But let me ask you, so as someone who plays so often, I do think that you've shared some helpful
advice on openings, but what's your philosophy with regard to like a narrow versus a broad repertoire? Are you kind of focused on core openings or are you playing different stuff?
No, I'm trying to stick to a very particular set of openings. It's not a very broad repertoire. It's in fact very narrow. But I think it sort of evolves over time because I think the best thing to begin with is just, all right, what are typical, let's say, all right, what are my basic answers to e4, d4, c4, knight f3, right? When you have at least like first couple moves, you have at least some idea of what might evolve, right? Let's say against e4, for example, you play Karokan, right? Then there is just a certain number of lines. As you start studying it more in depth, you start looking at particular lines, particular variations, and you get deeper and deeper and deeper. And more you play, more interesting things you see when you do subsequent analysis. So in that sense, I stick to a very narrow repertoire, but I also try to find new lines, new ideas, maybe new things to try. Sometimes, you know, I would, let's say, get some repertoire course. I will see that, all right, this is like, you know, this is the line that's recommended by this grandmaster. And I will try to play it a couple times and I will realize, you know what, positions I'm getting are maybe fine, but I don't understand them really well. So now the question is, should I study those positions more or maybe should I study something that matches my current level of development better so that, you know, I can get some results right now, not 2 years later.
Okay. And you, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're playing pretty frequently at your local club. So I'm guessing that that means that you play, you're playing some of the same players more than once. Is that true, Dennis?
Yeah, I play one game a week at the Westchester Chess Club. By the way, it's an amazing place. If you live anywhere close to the Philadelphia area, worth visiting. We get about 30 players each week, and we play slow over-the-board games, so 100 minutes per game for each player. So I do tend to play same people over and over, and initially I thought that, you know, that's quite a bit of a disadvantage because not necessarily you will develop that well if you get same opponents every few weeks. But then on the other hand, even if you think about playing chess at a really high level, you know, most of the time you get same opponents over and over again, I guess, at any spot of your chess development, right? So I think it's both helping and not, in the sense that they can prepare to something that you play and you can prepare to something they play, and it sort of tests your opening repertoire better, but it also gives you motivation to look for different ideas and maybe to look deeper into some openings that otherwise you would never look in. But then, you know, it always comes in handy, you know, when it comes to some larger tournament where you suddenly see the same line and you already know what to play in it, even though your opponent maybe was trying to catch you by surprise.
Okay, so you're not developing like a B repertoire, even though you might be an air quote stationary target for a certain opponent if you're black against them for the third time or something.
Look, as of now, I'm struggling even with my A repertoire, right? Yeah. Right? Maybe when I'm done with that, I will try to develop my B repertoire and maybe some C repertoire and maybe something else for Blitz and Bullet or whatever. But at this point, I feel like, you know, there is still more interesting things I can get from my basic openings.
Yeah, well, we all feel that way, I think. I mean, at least as amateurs, we all feel like our openings could be better. But is that like really rooted in reality? Like, obviously, you've had outlier gains. So it doesn't seem like your openings are holding you back. But do you feel like for your rating of now over 2000 USCF, do you feel like there are relative weakness your openings compared to other aspects of your game?
Maybe to an extent, maybe, right? But I also don't think that this is such a dramatic weakness that's really holding me back right now. In a sense that I don't remember, I do remember because it's very painful to remember. So you remember this for a long time, but I don't lose a game straight out of an opening too often, right? If I get a playable position, it's maybe slightly better or a tiny little bit worse. That's probably good enough, right? Because I don't think you will win or lose too many games in the opening unless you do something, you know, unless you remember every single move or maybe, you know, you do something atrociously bad, right? So in that sense, I don't think that's a major weakness. But, you know, there is also this constant feeling that I'm sure many chess players have experienced, that anytime you go to play in any larger tournament, you go there and you almost feel like, you know what, if I had a couple weeks more to prepare, I would have been in such a better shape. Right. Like, just a tiny little bit more, I would be in such a better shape, right? But then, you know, you play in the next tournament a couple months down the road, and you're still there. You know, you always have this feeling. And I had this feeling when I was, you know, at 16, 1700, and I have this feeling at 2000 right now. And I'm sure, you know, you will have this feeling anytime, right? You can always do something better. But in that sense, playing chess is an interesting activity, in the sense that you sort of need, if you are a perfectionist, you need to kill that feeling in you, right? Because it's not about knowing all ins and outs. It's not about playing absolutely precisely, right? It's not about your 99.9 whatever percent chess.com accuracy. It's just winning a game. You can make 10 mistakes along the way, and if you win, you won, right? And if you played a generally nice game, but something happened and you lost, then you lost. In that sense, chess is a very fair game, you know?
Yeah, it's true. After the break, Dennis will get into his routine for solving chess puzzles, plus much more.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we are back. And Dennis, I also wanted to talk about the exercises you're doing. So you've mentioned chess tempo. I know you're also doing chess steps. You've mentioned in your Reddit post that you'll use a physical set for the exercises that you're doing. How did you settle on those resources and that routine?
Yeah, so I have chess tempo. Chess tempo, obviously, I solve it either on my laptop or on my phone. And I would not set a physical board for that. I use physical board for playing through games, mm-hmm. playing through classical games or maybe even some modern games. And then every once in a while, I would have some books, like, for example, books by Artur Yusupov. I feel like examples are definitely worth studying on an actual physical board, but also when it comes to exercises, a good deal of those are fairly difficult. So it's also nice to set them on the board and maybe sit for 10-15 minutes thinking about, you know, more difficult puzzles. When it comes to chess steps, to the steps method, I think it really depends on the level of difficulty. So I just went through the step 5, which is supposed to be aiming on players at about 1900 level. So what I did, I went through all the sessions in that step one by one, and I solved all the puzzles in the basic workbook. And I solved them just, you know, seeing them on the page without using the board, just, you know, looking at the printout and solving this in my head, right? Whether this is for white or for black, I would just look at the board the way it is and I would try to solve it. Then for all the topics where I scored less than 75%, I took this topic separately. You know, I had a list of these topics, and then I solved all the puzzle for these topics from the extra workbook, from the plus workbook. So essentially all the additional exercises you can get. And at least I made sure that I pay enough attention and I focus on these exercises and I get above, you know, 75-80% correct. So now I went through the whole book, through all the workbooks, and I went through extra workbooks for topics where I thought that I was struggling. Now I'm going to start step six and I'm going to see if it's any better or worse. Most likely it's going to be more difficult. So maybe I will need a little bit more, you know, iterations on each topic to get this correct. Overall, that's the plan, right? For more simple tasks, I try to solve it from the book. And for more difficult tasks, I will try to set it on the board. When it comes to playing through games, I will set them on the board. But then when it comes to shorter sub-variations or annotations, I would try to play them in my head, at least until I see the point of the author. Like, for example, there is a variation which says that that move was not possible because after this, and this, black loses a piece. And I will try to visualize it all the way so that I can see why black is losing that piece, right? And maybe there is some simple tactic at the end, but, you know, I will still try to keep this position in my head. And I will think, all right, you know what? I got how it works. Now let's move on with the next move of the game.
Okay. Yeah. And for listeners who, I mean, chess steps come up probably regularly enough in the podcast where a lot of listeners will be familiar with them. But just in case anyone isn't, there's a Dutch curriculum. It's a Dutch curriculum. And as Dennis mentioned, he's at step five, which is approximately 1800 to 2000 level. And there's six steps. So the good thing about the curriculum is that, you know, basically from, you know, 900 on up, you can find a series of books that are reasonably well suited. And it's mostly tactical puzzles, but not completely. They're inexpensive. The only downside is there are no real explanations for the answers. So if you're working on your own, Dennis is strong enough where he's often going to be able, as he just mentioned, to figure out the answers. But I think for newer players, that is a potential friction point. And it can be helpful to work with a coach or at least have a coach that for the answers that you don't understand, you can like set the problems aside and ask them about.
Yeah, I think it becomes a little bit more strategic over time. So, for example, if steps one and two are simple tactics, step six is a little bit more strategic. Typical topics would be, let's say, king in the center or attacking on the king side or, you know, something along these lines. And then they have manuals for teachers, for coaches, where they also explain at least ideas behind some topics. At least the valuable, I think the valuable thing about these books as well, about workbooks specifically, is that first, you can go through things that you think you know and actually test if that's the case. Like, for example, I'm pretty good when it comes to rook and pawn versus rook endgames. I solved a lot of these. I know ideas. I know how to win. I know how to draw, right? But still, you know, you go through, I don't know, 24, 36 puzzles on that topic, and you realize that there might be some more, you know, intricate positions where it takes a little bit more than basic knowledge to at least, you know, simplify it to the extent where you would face a position you already know. So in that sense, it's simple. You know, you go through these topics. If something is very easy for you, you're going to solve the whole set of 12 exercises in maybe 10 minutes, and you'll be like, all right, you know, at least I know this, that's good, let's move on. But then every once in a while, even at lower steps, you would find something where you would think, oh, you know what, I sort of missed this. And over time, I get this feeling that it's a curriculum, right? So you go through this, and you get a body of knowledge, right? You don't get particular topics. It's not like, you know, I was excited about the French defense, I watched that YouTube video, now I know about this particular line, but maybe, you know, there are a ton of different things I'm missing. Here, you go through these topics, you go through steps, and eventually you get to the point where you feel like, all right, you know, there is like something I know about chess. It sort of starts here, it ends here, and it's a set of knowledge. It's not just random thoughts, things here and there, you know?
Yeah, yeah. They really do have a wide variety of puzzles and cover a lot of topics. So definitely you could do worse than that as a resource. Now, Dennis, in terms of your coach, I'm curious, is it mostly game review that you're doing with him, or what sort of work do you do with your coach, and how often do you guys meet?
So we get together every week. We have one lesson, and the duration of that lesson is 1 hour. We go through the game I played that week, and as I mentioned, I have weekly games at the local chess club, so it's always at least one game per week, and then every once in a while, I would take the whole weekend to play in some of those weekend tournaments where you can get 5 or 6 games in 2 or 3 days, and then, you know, we would go through this. The game review, it depends on the game, but it might take anywhere from, let's say, 15 minutes to 45 minutes, or maybe the whole hour if the game is really complex, right? Most of the time, we would go through the game and some of general concepts that I missed. My coach will give me some maybe similar examples from classical games, or maybe from his games, or maybe from games of his students as well. Like, for example, last week, I actually lost a pretty painful game, right? So I showed this to my coach, and, you know, we went through some mistakes I made. And then he also said that, oh, you know what? I have this game by Simagin from 1958, and let me show you the structure. But you know what? The structure, that's really interesting, because you know what? There is that fourth game between Kasparov and Karpov from their second world championship match. And this is the same pawn structure, and this is how they played it. And you can see how, you know, Karpov slowly outplayed his opponent by doing this, this, and that. And it sort of helps you to get those concepts and maybe connect them to a more general picture when it's not just, hey, you know, you made some mistake here, but also, you know what, there are some examples. There are some examples to demonstrate that idea. Maybe a good example would be our first lesson ever. He went through the database of my games. I sent him about 100 games I had recorded. He went through this, and one of his particular topics for the first class was the topic of two bishops. Why two bishops are better than bishop versus knight most of the time. So he showed me a couple classical examples, and then he also sent me a game from a recent chess Olympiad, and he essentially said, look, I mean, this is an endgame. You have 4 pawns on each side. You have 2 bishops versus bishop and knight. And maybe the computer says that it's holdable. It's not lost yet, right? It's not lost by any means. But then if you look at next 60 moves, this is where this player with 2 bishops was chasing his opponent, and his opponent was suffering through those 60 moves. And just think about how easy versus how difficult it was to play for each of those 2 participants. And, you know, you get some of these ideas, and you can see how your game relates to some games played before. And you also realize that it's same thing as, you know, tactical patterns, where you see, you know, same types of checkmates or same types of tactics over and over again, and eventually you learn to find them pretty fast in your games. Same goes with strategy, when you realize, you know what, this pawn structure, it's been there before. You know, there were some games played in a similar way. There were similar ideas, similar thoughts, similar plans, and this is how great players of, you know, past years, they got to where they got. And that starts making more sense. You just memorize this better. And every once in a while, when we go through a game, he would stop for a second and he would say, all right, now what's a good move for white and why? And I think the coolest thing for me is that I not only it's interesting whether I'm thinking whether I made a mistake or not, right? It's interesting whether I'm thinking the right way. So I can actually walk him through my thoughts, explain that, all right, you know, in this position, I made this move because I thought that I had a choice of 3 moves. This move was something I didn't like for that reason. That move I didn't like for this reason. In this case, all right, I'm giving up a pawn, but at least I get some activity. I'm thinking there is a compensation for it. And this is what my logic is. And then he would say something like, all right, you know, that makes sense. That's reasonable. I would probably do the same. Or he would say, you know what, this is completely wrong because, you know, this is not the direction you should be going, and let me explain you why. And he would explain in a more strategic way, but then he might also show some tactical ideas that, you know, right, you know, that sort of makes sense, but, you know, unfortunately that blunders a piece, right? So that's very helpful just in terms of describing my train of thought and getting immediate feedback. Am I thinking right about this? Or maybe I'm completely going the opposite direction, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Sounds like a great teacher. I mean, it sounds like there's plenty to learn from David.
Look, the biggest thing for me was finding an actual teacher, right? Finding an actual coach, someone who coaches people professionally. And we also set some goals in terms of, you know, certain performance, certain maybe rating goals. I don't want to go super in depth on that because probably disclosing that means more commitment. But with that, with that, it's important to have someone who knows how to teach, because there are plenty of good players who play really well, but not necessarily they can explain their exact thought process or their exact logic. In fact, you know, there is a well-known story when Mikhail Botvinnik was trying to develop a chess computer, one of these like earlier chess programs that was supposed to think like a grandmaster. I think Mikhail Tal mentioned that, you know, the problem of Botvinnik is that not only he wants to teach the computer to think like him, his problem is that he thinks he knows how he thinks, you know? So that's the challenge. That's the challenge here.
Okay. Yeah. And last thing on your coach, he actually, to your point about him showing you all these sort of classic themes, he has a new Chessable course out called Lessons from the Classic Center Play, which where I'm sure he was able to draw on his vast knowledge. And there's a free preview, like a free 15-minute video that listeners can check out if they're interested in seeing David's material. So Dennis, this has been quite insightful, as I expected. Now, my big question for you, I have my own theories about the answer to this, but you're doing things that it sounds like, you know, as we've discussed, it's not, you're not reinventing the wheel. There's nothing like totally out of left field that other people have not mentioned before, but you are having success that's quite rare. So do you have any theories for why that might be?
I mean, success is a very relative term, right? I think I mentioned this in my Reddit post. You know, at any level, whether I'm 1600 rated or 1800 or 2000, I'm always thinking that my chess is absolutely terrible. But maybe, you know, 200 points, 300 points later is when real chess starts. So right now, I'm also playing against some stronger players. I would, you know, get beaten pretty badly in some tournaments. And I look at this and I think, all right, you know what, maybe 2300 USCF is where it becomes more like high quality chess, right? But what I'm doing right now, there are so many mistakes. This is so terrible. The problem is that maybe when I was 1700, I was thinking exactly the same way, right? So not necessarily this is, you know, this is a conclusive success, but at least I hope I'm moving in the right direction. And I think the biggest thing is just developing some maybe system, some approach and sticking to it, and not shying away from doing something that you're not necessarily comfortable doing. Because I think with most activities, chess specifically, and maybe even more so in recent years, there are a lot of maybe opportunities for instant gratification, right? When you can just watch a YouTube video and say that, all right, you know, I studied chess for 30 minutes. Well, maybe yes, but maybe no, right? You can watch some YouTube videos and take notes and think about this and, you know, play through some games that are being shown. Or you can just, you know, enjoy some entertainment and, you know, have fun, but then it has nothing to do with actual studying, right? And maybe sometimes it's doing something that's a little bit painful for you, something that's a little bit uncomfortable, doing something that you might think is boring. But also knowing that, you know, any activity, anything you do in this life has a routine component, has an exciting component, and it's very difficult to have just all the pleasures without having some more painful things. And, you know, that's the beauty of it. You know, you can have a lot of different experiences along the way. Consistency is always important, right? Just doing a little bit, even if you are not in your best shape, you don't have too much time, just, you know, do something. Doing something is always doing better than doing nothing. And yeah, I think being generally open-minded, trying to learn things, being open to feedback, and not reinventing the wheel, right? Yeah. There are a lot of different curriculums, there are a lot of different systems, a lot of approaches, and just pick what works for you and try to work with it. You know, there are a lot of programs, there are a lot of coaches out there are a lot of classes, courses, whatever you can come up with. I think there are plenty of opportunities to study chess. Just you know, be open-minded.
Okay. Yeah. Consistency is what I had hit on too. Yeah. It really stands out to me. And for listeners who heard my interview with NM Todd Bryant, where he looked at a lot of the most accomplished improvers in the U.S. and just without necessarily knowing all of them, but knowing some of them and looking at their rating graphs, as Todd highlighted, they just competed so often. So the fact that you're doing that and putting in a lot of work on top of that, I'm glad to see that that it's paying off. Although, of course, there are more important things in life than rating points anyway. but I'm glad to see that the hard work for now is leading to good things. And when you play weekend tournaments, Dennis, is your approach any different? Do you play all the, like, do you ever skip a round? How do you approach it when the club games as opposed to the weekend grinders?
Yeah, I try not to take all these shortened schedules. For example, when you can fit the same number of games into fewer days. Like, for example, there are certain tournaments where you can play Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, two games per day, and it gets you to six rounds. Or sometimes you can take a two-day schedule. That would mean that you play three rapid games on Saturday morning, and then you play a long game on Saturday afternoon, and then you have two more games on Sunday. I tried doing that. I realized that by the end of my third rapid game, I'm pretty much dead, and I want to go crawl back home, you know, and get some rest. And the long game in the evening is not helping the issue, right? So I try to stick to full schedules. If I don't have time, for example, to play on Friday, I would take a bye in first two rounds and then have a proper four-round tournament, as opposed to trying to fit everything in. Another thing is just feeling where you are in terms of the form, in terms of your current mood and, you know, your current mindset, and maybe trying to make some adjustments based on that. Like, for example, I had an instance where I offered a quick draw in the last round because, you know, I didn't really feel like I was in my best shape to play. And sometimes you just get tired and you think, all right, you know what, this game decides nothing. Apparently it's the same case for my opponent. I just want to get out of this tournament. It's been horrible, right? And then you try to cut your losses and, you know, try not to suffer through what you don't have to suffer through. With that, obviously, you know, you have a little bit of flexibility in choosing your openings or, you know, approaches to the game. Sometimes you want and quiet, peaceful game where you think, all right, I'm going to get something playable and I can play that. Sometimes you feel like you want blood, you know, and then you go after something sharp, you know, some very precise variations. You feel like, you know, you're in a good spot to pursue this strategy. It's also interesting how it works in each subsequent day based on how the previous day went. Like, for example, if you have two painful blunders and two painful losses on Saturday, it's sort of difficult to get yourself together and continue playing on Sunday. And I still do, and I learn a lot about, you know, how to approach this better and how to, you know, not necessarily forget about what happened, but at least try to start the next day from a clean page and, you know, just do your best given the circumstances. But I know sometimes, you know, you lose two games in a row to maybe opponents you should not have lost to, and then you come back home and you cannot get to sleep until 2 a.m. or something, and then next morning you wake up at 7 and you go play. That's also something to learn. And by the way, in that sense, having a good coach is also helpful, because there is also a great deal of advice when it comes to tournament strategy, when it comes to, you know, some psychological elements of the struggle and all these related things, that whatever, you know, whatever you're facing in these tournaments, it's not a new problem. You know, many people have had the same thing before. So it's helpful. It's important when someone can explain you what are potential options.
Okay. Great advice. And I think my last question, Dennis, I mean, of course, you mentioned my system having made a difference for you in your earlier years. Where do chess books fit into your chess life? And do you have any favorites?
Stay tuned for more book recommendations and final thoughts from Dennis Markov. We'll be right back.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back.
Oh, I absolutely love chess books. We can record a whole new episode on chess books only, and I can, you know, walk you through my bookshelf. Some of the recommendations I had, obviously, I mentioned Arturo Yusupov's book.
Yeah, is that the Build Up Your Chess series?
Yeah. That's 10 books. You have the orange level, you have the blue level and the green level, and they probably have some more appropriate proper names, you know, but this is what they're known for. You know, you can just search for Yusupov books on Google and you will find this whole series of 10 books. Something I recently read, some books I really liked, Sam Shankland's books on pawn play. These are really good, very good illustrative examples. Endgame Strategy by Mikhail Sherishevsky. Long-time classic, amazing book. I feel like, you know, when it comes to specifically strategic topics, endgame strategy is a good place to begin at, just because it's a little bit simpler in a way that, you know, you have fewer pieces on the board and ideas are more clear, and then this endgame knowledge somehow translates into some middle game components as well. At least it teaches you to think in plans, in concepts, in ideas, you know, in schemes. Not just, you know, if I do this, my opponent does that and I will do this, but like, where do I need to position my bishop so that, let's say, this breakthrough on the king side is working. Right. And then when you start thinking in these terms, you know, it kind of gets you to some deeper level of understanding. Johan Halston books on middle game and end game strategy as well. Again, you know, almost classical books by now. I've heard about them many times on the podcast, but, you know, also read both of them and they're super helpful. Long-term classic, Grandmaster Floris Rios, the book about pawn structures.
Yeah, chess structures.
Yeah, not necessarily this is a full guide on all the potential structures you might get, but at least when you go through some examples there, at least through structures that you face pretty often, you sort of realize the right way of thinking about this. When you see some typical plans for each side, and then, you know, when you know these typical plans, you can also go through database, find a lot of games and see, all right, this is what this plan is looking like, this is what's being implemented in this game, and this is what they're trying to do, and it gives you just better idea. For example, you know, pick any opening, you know, French defense, advanced variation, you know, that's a typical pawn structure, and you have some ideas around it. You go through this book, you go through some games, and even though you may not necessarily know all the exact move orders yet, your level of understanding improves dramatically because you get the idea of what's happening. And then there is a great book by Ivan Sokolov, Winning Middle Game Strategies. I would say it's very similar to the book on pawn structures, but it's way more advanced, it's way more difficult. But it's also very interesting. It's just a good deal of pretty deep examples. And I feel like, you know, going through this book, first, it's interesting. Second, it's deep. Third, even if you don't play certain structures, some of the strategic topics, they sort of overlap with what you might be playing. Like, you know, I think the first chapter was about doubled pawns you get out of Nimza Indian, you know, when black takes on c3 and you capture with the b pawn, and then you get these doubled pawns on b3 and c4, and, you know, black tries to attack c4 and white tries to develop some initiative on the king side. And there are a lot of intricacies there, but I think there are about 12 different examples related to this specific pawn structure. And there are plenty of good ideas where you just feel like, all right, you know, I'm starting to understand something here. You know, some ideas come together because it's just, you know, it's a good book with a lot of good examples. And obviously, Ivan Sokolov is an amazing coach I think you had him on the podcast. It was a great episode, and he spoke about his coaching career as well.
Yeah.
So I guess these are some of the most recent recommendations. I can keep going. I can give you like another 20, but these are my recent favorites, at least.
Yeah. Sokolov, I'm a huge fan of his. I actually haven't had a chance to interview him for Perpetual Chess. I interviewed him for How to Chess. Then it hasn't.
All right. Here we go. Right. Right.
It hasn't been released, mm-hmm. actually, and I'm hoping it will see the light of day soon. But in any event, someone I'd love to interview at some point. But he's done. You're probably thinking of a great interview he did with Chess Base India. He did like a little media tour. Especially after his success coaching the Uzbek team. But yeah, a great author and content creator and entertaining as well. So Yeah, fantastic recommendations throughout, Dennis, as I expected. Of course, I'm a fan of all the books you mentioned as well. And yeah, I just think that there's a lot for people to learn from your general no-nonsense sort of long-range approach to daily chess practice. Do you have anything to add before we wrap up, Dennis?
Yeah, I mean, look, I hope my experience might be helpful, might be useful for some people, but I'm also curious about other people's experience. So definitely, you know, feel free to reach out to me. I'm on Instagram. It's dvm0101, or you can send me an email to dvmarkov@gmail.com. And I'd be curious to hear your thoughts, opinions, maybe some advice you have to share. Maybe, you know, some people would say that, you know, that's all complete nonsense and something else worked for me. Or maybe, you know what, this is going to work up to a certain level and then you will be struggling with something. Again, I think none of the struggles that I'm facing in my development are new. Many people went through the same experience. Many people had same type of situations. So I'm really curious to hear from other people and try to learn from them.
Okay, excellent. I'll make a note in the show notes, as always, of the Instagram account and email address. So anyone driving or walking around, you don't have to crash your car and try to write it down. I'll chase that down for you. But yeah, Dennis, thanks again. Look forward to seeing you at a local tournament sooner or later. Now that I found a chess league, I'm struggling to make it to the weekend tournaments, and I feel like you might be in the same boat. We both missed the one in New Jersey recently, but sooner or later, I'm sure we'll meet IRL again.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a pleasure, and good luck with the forthcoming episodes, and good luck with your podcast. As I said, I'm a huge fan, and I'm looking forward to what you else have to offer the chess community.
Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.